Hey, podcast listeners, Ed Stasium, record producer, interesting guy. We talk just a minute from now, but I want to let you know, if you head over to WFMU.org/Michael, you will see the list of upcoming interviews, and they include Scott Ligon of the new NRBQ, Larry Tamblyn of the Standells, Tom Doyle, author of this new book about Paul McCartney called Man on the Run, soul music guy Bobby Patterson, 60s guy P.F. Sloan, and the great Deke Dickerson, sort of roots rock king, as far as I'm concerned. They're all on the schedule coming up in the next few weeks or so. So check out WFMU.org/Michael for all the information about that. Hope your summer's going well. This is the first show I've done in shorts this year. So if you hear a difference, that's what it is. All right, talk to you soon. Here is my interview with Ed Stasium.
But he so found out the hard way that dreams don't always come true. So he burned all his hopes. Ooh, ooh, and he even sold his old car. Bought a one-way ticket back to the life he once knew. Oh, yes, he did. He said,
I have no argument with any part of that record. Just the best there, you know? Some records hold up. Gladys Knight and the Pips, Midnight Train to Georgia, and Ed Stasium joins us on the phone. Good morning. How are you?
Happy solstice, Michael.
Happy solstice. You know, that is just a great record. I just love every minute. I mean, I've heard it a billion times, you know, since I was a little boy, and it's still great. Let me catch the audience up. You're from New Jersey. You played in this band called Brandywine. They get signed to a recording contract, and during that process, somehow you get more involved in the technical end and realize that's maybe where I should be. And in 1972, you start working at a place called Venture Sound in Somerville, New Jersey, and that's the beginning of your behind the glass career. And at what point did Gladys Knight and the Pips show up?
We actually recorded the vocals for Midnight Train, for that particular song, in Detroit. People always ask me what the studio was, and of course, I've forgotten. some guy's name, I forgot. I'm sorry. But we did record those vocals in Detroit, and it was a one-take vocal for Gladys, and later on in New York City, we went into Bell Sound and punched in a little bit at the end, one of those I Got to Go's. Yeah, and it was great. It was great. I had no idea, of course, that it was going to be a huge number one record and a Grammy winner for that year. That's 74 it was, actually. And it was just a great experience. That was the, back at in those days, we were still with, we did have WNEW-FM that us groovy people listened to. And we still, had WABC, the great WABC, which, I listened to throughout the entire 1960s. And it was the first record that I worked on that I ever heard on the radio. And that was a big thrill for me.
I'll bet it was. I mean, you talked about, I didn't know it was going to be a hit. That's a great little topic. Do you know, sometimes you've worked on hundreds of records, do you have like a radar that says, you know, if this song has a chance, and is that radar wrong or right, or do you not even go there?
I really never go there, although I can say that I know what I like, and I like a lot of, I like most of the work that I've done, and you know, 90% of that work that I've done has never seen the light of day. I mean, it's seen release, but as you well know, I would say maybe even 95% of the material that I've recorded is not a hit, and you just don't know. You know what's good, but you don't know what's going to, who knows? I've never really paid attention to that. I've never made a record for the fact of it being a hit. Like, you know, I'm sure there are some people, and more power to them, they go in there and say, we're going to have a hit record. This is going to be a hit record. We're going to make it sound like a hit record. Chorus goes here and it sounds like this. Blah, 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 blah. didn't do that. I did it for the love of music, always did it for the love of music. And I started off playing music and bands, and you know, I still do it for music. Never got really involved with the business aspect.
But
of
sometimes you're in the
recording industry.
You're in the studio with a band, and they've got 10 songs, and one of them sounds like, you know, it might have a chance. Do you put a little extra into that one sometimes?
No extra. I do the same with every song I'm working on, with every record I'm working on.
They're all hits.
Might have been, you know, a name group or an unknown group. I put this, or just, you know, the kids down the street, which I've done on occasion, you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
I've put just as much effort into every project that I've worked on.
No, I love that. I love treating every song like it's a hit. Let's, you know, let's boom, let's do it. So you transfer from working at Venture Sound to working, you go to Canada for a little while, and you get, in 1976, you become one of the guys who puts together the Power Station, which became a legendary New York City place. Was there a change in music in the air? I mean, because the difference in the way records, I think, like Gladys Knight and the Pips record was made, as opposed to the records you started making in the Power Station, things have changed subtly. Did you see it change? Did you feel it changed? And did the technical process of records change in those few years?
I don't believe the technical process really changed, but the music certainly changed. I was working for Tony Camello out there in Jersey. Had a great time. What a great guy he is. Good friend of mine, David Dominich, was also working there. He went on to do all the Lenny Kravitz records, and now is the king of Hoboken real estate, right near you guys in Jersey City. I had moved up to Canada, and at that time, you know, everything, you know, right before that, everything soft rock, I listened to the Eagles, I listened to Fleetwood Mac, you have Yes, you have all these progressive bands. It kind of lost the essence of real early rock and roll. You know, the simple, even the blues, you go, you know, Muddy Waters goes into the studio, says everything live in one take. And, you know, hey, I was listening to that stuff, you know, at that point. Johnny Ramone even said, you know, Ed, oh yes, Ed, he likes the Eagles. You know, I was listening to the Eagles records. They sounded great, you know. Bill Simjic did a fabulous job producing that stuff. It took a real long time to do that stuff. I was up, like I said, I was up in Canada listening to Sham FM. It was kind of the WNEW FM of Montreal, you know, Peter Frampton coming over the airwaves. And I was up there isolated. I wasn't in New York, so I didn't know about the scene that was happening at CBGB's, but that whole revolution that was going on. When I came back to start up what was to be Power Station with Tony Bon Jovi and Bob Walters, I actually left the studio I was working in, a really nice residential studio called List Studio Moore and Heights, where I got to witness the Bee Gees making all that Saturday Night Fever. I didn't really work on it, but I hung out with Barry Gibb and, you know, smoked dope and swapped books about existential philosophy. So, you know, I was held up in that thing. I came back to New York. Tommy Ramone contacted Tony Bon Jovi to work on the second Ramones record, Leave Home. And I was just thrown into it. I was thrown into the CBGBs, you know, zip out of Montreal, move back to Jersey, boom, I'm in the studio, you know, literally 4 days after I got back from Montreal, with the Ramones, you know, tracking Leave Home. And I was like, whoa, what is this? This is awesome. It was great. It was, you know, because I started off as a guitar player, you know, learning my three chords. First song I learned was Let There Be Drums, boom. Well, I didn't play drums, but I played guitar, did Let There Be Drums. And it was just very simple, straight ahead, powerful, great songs, a lot of humor, and we got along. So that whole scene, you know, music was changing at that time, and look how it's changed over the last 40 years. You know, the first Ramones record just went gold in April.
Yeah.
38 years it took. 38 years.
It's amazing.
Amazing.
Now they're in car commercials and et cetera, et cetera. It is an incredible change the world has gone through, and looking at it, for, you know, tracking music through that change is and how it's accepted by the world is kind of mind-blowing sometimes. So let's talk about the Ramones. I mean, one of my all-time favorite bands, and sort of a sound that you were able to, you know, we heard Joan Jett earlier, and we heard the Smithereens earlier, and we heard Marshall Crenshaw earlier, and they're all kind of big, loud guitar records, and you sort of, that became sort of your thing in a way. And we were talking about earlier in the program how, you know, you've worked with Mick Jagger and the Plasmatics and Carly Simon and Shanana and the Living Color, the Chambers Brothers, the Hoodoo Gurus, the Misfits. It's a wide bunch of music, but that kind of powerful guitar thing is kind of what you're most known for, I'd say. I mean, when they showed up to play, were they ready to make a record?
Well, with when we speak about the bands that I've worked with, that I've produced, recorded and mixed, such as, you know, Living Color, Smithereens, we would go into a rehearsal situation previous to going into the recording studio, and we would go over the songs. Sometimes there would be, you know, 15 songs, sometimes there'd be 20 songs, sometimes, depending what record it was. Sometimes there'd be 12 songs, and we would hone down the songs, and usually a two-week pre-production period. Talk about the Smithereens. My good friend Mark Fried, who was working for BMI, now runs Spirit Music in New York. He hooked me up with the boys, good old Jersey boys. I mean, Pat DiNizio actually always tells a story of, I worked at a small music store on Route 22 in North Plainfield, New Jersey. I kind of ran the, I gave guitar lessons and I ran the guitar section. And Pat tells me that he remembered me from working there because I always used to let him in and try out the guitars that were hanging on the wall. Pretty fun. So we did 2 weeks of pre-production. You know, I was sent the demos probably on cassette back then. When was that? 89-ish? We did
something like that.
Smithereens 11. You know, listen to the songs and, you know, got my cassette, make a list, put stars next to the songs that I really liked. I had a system of making asterisks, you know. Three was great. Two was really, really good. And, you know, I had my half a star, that kind of thing. So during pre-production, we would talk about which songs we really wanted to do, which songs we weren't going to do. And then we would go into, I would put my two cents in since I started, you know, being in bands. And looking way back when, you know, when I was like 12 years old, 13 years old, and started playing in bands, I was the kid with the guitar, and I actually had a tape recorder. I would be the one to go out and buy the records, and I'd, you know, write down the lyrics. I'd figure out the songs, and then go to into the band. You know, back in, you know, 1964, I'd go to the, we call it band. We didn't call it rehearsal. It was called band practice in the basement. And we literally, you know, it was all basement. It was all basement stuff, and sorry, somebody's texting me. Hi, John DiNicola. I would be in basements and garages. We really, you know, rehearsed in garage bands, practiced in garages, and I would go over the songs with the guys in the band. I'd be the one to figure it out. So just, I guess, me becoming a producer was just a transformation of that period in my life where I would start going over the songs with the band and put in my two cents. Easily said, you know, maybe we should chop that intro in half, maybe we shouldn't go to the chorus after the first verse, maybe you should put in a little, go to the introduction again, and then go to a second verse and then go to a chorus. The song needs a bridge, that type of advice, opinion. It's just about opinion. And, you know, I try to become a member of the band while I'm working on a particular record and just shout out what I think of the arrangement of the song, maybe a little chord change, maybe a lyric change. Nothing serious. It's not a dictatorship. It's a collaboration with the band. So, you know, it could be shot down or it could be used in the arrangement. And that's how we would start it off. You know, 2 weeks of that, go over every song, rehearse it, maybe change, you know, kick drum part, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, go into the studio and start recording.
Let's talk about the Ramones. It's a known fact that you play guitar on some Ramones records, but it's not exactly. I think we had Monty Melman on a while ago. We had
Monty Melnick.
Yeah, Melnick. We've had Johnny's wife on. We've had Richie Ramone on, and it's hard to get the everyone has a different version of what happened in the Ramones. It's kind of interesting and typical, I think, of how the Ramones family sort of operated. But I mean, you know, what percentage of guitar playing did Johnny do? Did the band play live in the studio? And what percent do you do on those Ramones records?
Well, we always recorded the band live, and we usually kept it. I mean, we didn't do a lot of editing in those days. Are we there?
Are you there? I'm still here.
Okay. Yeah, because I got some static in here. Sorry about that. We recorded the band live and always did a reference vocal with Joey. We would definitely redo the vocals, get better vocals, although Joey's reference vocals were always great as well. Johnny always did his thing. Johnny Ramone was, and always will be a specialist in what he does. He's an innovator. He's a powerhouse. He is the man at what he does. And at one point, even during Leave Home, I always carried my trusty 63 Fender Stratocaster around with me to sessions. And we became very friendly right at the top, and there were certain things that Johnny really was not interested in playing. And I had ideas for, like we discussed earlier, I had ideas for little things. So I believe that the first bit I suggested to Johnny was in Susie is a Headbanger. In the I said, why don't you do like a kind of a ballsy Duane Eddy kind of lick on top of the guitar just to emphasize that section? And Johnny just says, no, Eddie, you do it. You do it. It'll be easy for you to do. You know what you want to do. Just do it. And from that time on, every time I would suggest a part that wasn't in Johnny's specialty realm, I would just start playing it. And, you know, that's how that worked. So, you know, then... when we did the single, Sheena is a Punk Rocker, Johnny and Tommy, that we wanted to do like a Beach Boys, Little Honda kind of ding, 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 and with a muted, cleaner guitar than Johnny's. So actually, I think Tommy suggested that. And I just pulled out the guitar and threw it down. And it just continued from there. Boom.
And by
the time we got to Road to Ruin, you know, Tommy and I were in the studio a lot. You know, Johnny, the band did their thing. We did vocals with Joey. And we had visions of... Actually, you talked about hit records earlier. You know, we had visions of making this Road to Ruin a hit record. So we did, Tommy and I did as much as we could to emphasize and create a bit of a different texture than had been done on the previous three records. So we started, you know, throwing acoustic guitars on and... You know, little solo bits, and you know, one note solo on "I Want to Be Sedated." That I must say was inspired by Neil Young, his solo on "Cinnamon" on a "Cinnamon Girl." Yeah, so it just continued from there, and it was always Eddie, you do that, and then we would record them. Johnny would come in and either approve or disapprove. Just yeah, that sounds great, or nah, we don't want that.
All right, let
there are some parts that...
Let me remind everybody, we're talking to Ed Stasium here on the mighty WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Let's talk about the Phil Spector record, End of the Century. You have a sort of a credit that's not here or there. Some people have suggested that maybe Phil wasn't up to the job, and eventually you did some of the production on that record. Is that accurate, or what happened?
I believe that's accurate. I believe that the band actually did a lot of the production on that. I can say from probably being the only one surviving who was there for every minute of the recording, except for the mixing. I was not involved with the mixing at all. But I was there for every minute of the recording. The guys wanted me there. Seymour Stein wanted me there. Johnny was a little adverse to the fact that Phil was going to do the record. Joey wanted Phil to do the record. So there was that little thing going on. But I must say that Phil didn't have much to do with the production whatsoever, except add some hand claps on almost every song, double the drums on some songs. I mean, we were rehearsing at SIR in Los Angeles for that. It was in May of 79, I believe. And we rehearsed for about, we actually, let me go back a little bit further. Let's go back about a month before that. I finished up a recording studio in the basement, an 8-track recording studio in the basement of Sire Records on West 73rd Street, between Amsterdam and Columbus. And we knocked out all of those songs that are on End of the Century in a day. Basically, the same arrangement that are on the record. We went to, just to tighten everything up, we rehearsed for 3 days in Los Angeles, previous to going to the studio. Phil came in. We worked on, the only song we didn't do at Sire Records was the Ballad of Jackie and Judy, which was actually written in the rehearsal space. And I remember coming up at the bridge for that particular song. That's probably the only musical song content contribution that I've done on a Ramones record. And Phil came in for the last day with his bodyguard and came in, "How are you?" Came in, put his briefcase down on the floor in front of the band, sat on his briefcase, folded his hands in front of him, and sat there while we played the songs and didn't say a word. Sat through every song, nodded his head a little bit, and went through the entire set of songs that we were going to record, and said, "Okay, great, we'll see you tomorrow in the studio." That was it. That was no suggestions about anything. Went into the studio, and the same thing. We started recording. It was very strange. I would talk to Phil on the telephone. I was at the Sunset Marquee. The band was at the Tropicana, the infamous Tropicana at Sunset and at Santa Monica and La Brea, I think it was. It's torn down now. I actually stayed at the Tropicana and my room got broken into, so I moved over to the more upscale Sunset Marquee, which actually wasn't so upscale at the time. Phil had an assistant. Her name is Donna, and she would call me several times a day at the Marquee and say, "Phil is going to call you in 15 minutes. And like clockwork, Phil would call me. And he told me, "Okay, we're going to record at Gold Star," which was really a thrill for me to be at Gold Star with the great Larry Levine as an engineer. I didn't even engineer the backing tracks. Larry Levine, the Grammy-winning, late and great Larry Levine did that stuff. And we all went to Gold Star Studios, myself and the band. Gold Star, Phil's there. Where's the equipment? For some reason, Phil told Donna to tell Monty Melnick to to go to Rumbo Recorders in the Valley. And this is at night. We started at night. We'd start 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. So it's like 11 o'clock, and Johnny's like, where's Monty? Where is he? What's going on? And, you know, there's no cell phones. Nobody knows where anybody is. Finally, you know, somehow Monty called Gold Star, and he had unloaded all of the equipment, all the gear, into the room at Rumbo, and they also thought that the Ramones were coming to Rumbo, but Phil told the band and myself that we're working at Gold Star. So that was just the beginning of the weirdness.
When Phil's in jail now, I mean, did you spend a lot of time in the same room with the guy? Is that a surprise to you?
You know, I have a soft spot for Phil. You know, I never saw a gun being pulled on anybody. We were kind of dinner pals. We went out to dinner almost every night at the Hamburger Hamlet on Doheny right off of Sunset. I couldn't get any stories out of him, but all he would talk about is how great and how great the Ramones were, and talked about everything about the band, how great Mark was, how great Joey's voice was, what a great player Johnny was, and how this particular record was going to be the biggest record of the Ramones' career, the biggest record of his career, and the biggest record of my career. He was convinced that this was going to be number one.
Was he on drugs?
I don't know if he was on any meds. He wasn't doing, you know, no... I don't believe there were any recreational drugs involved. Hmm. There might have been some, you know, psychological drugs involved, but I can't confirm that. He did go through... he had personality changes that were triggered by certain events in the studio. He would be mad at one minute and be happy at another minute, and he would dress for the occasion of being, you know, nice Phil or evil Phil. One particular... later on in the project, the great movie director Alan Arkush, who directed Rock and Roll High School, he wanted to meet Phil. He was a huge fan of, you know, Phil Spector, and I remember Alan even made me a cassette up of all, you know, his favorite Phil Spector songs, and, you know, brought it over to the Sunset Marquee, and we were listening to it on my little Sony 550 cassette player, little blaster. It was one of the first blasters. I still have one. I still use it. It's great. And Phil wanted to meet, I'll go back there. Alan Arkush was just stoked beyond compare to meet Phil Spector. And I would ask Phil occasionally, like, once a week, once every few days, you know, hey, Alan Arkush, he's a great guy, wants to come down and hang out at the studio, he's really friends with the guys, he wants to meet you. And so I said, okay, I'll let you know. And finally, when we were doing, we were a month into the project or so, and we were doing vocals, and it was the time for Phil to say, okay, Alan, okay, Ed, let's have Alan come down tonight. I said, great. So I called Alan. Alan's all stoked to come down to the studio. I remember Phil was nice Phil. So what I mean by nice Phil, they would have his contact lenses in. He would be dressed like a normal guy. He'd have his little newsboy hat on. He'd be happy. He'd be glad. And so Joey and I were doing backing vocals out in the room. Larry was engineering. Phil was just supervising. He would just, the only guidance he would ever give us was do it again. I do the same thing. Do it again. Do it again. Try it again. And Alan comes in. I see Alan. So we say, hey, how's it going? I go in. I introduce Alan to Phil. Phil looks up at Alan. Alan puts out his hand. Phil doesn't shake Alan's hand. And Phil says, go sit down. And there's a little couch in front of the console. And Alan sat down, and Phil left the room and didn't come back for like a half hour. And he came back as the other Phil, which was, a cape, sunglasses and his wig and different clothes. It was kind of bizarre, and he just wouldn't speak to Alan the entire time he was there. And it was actually kind of rude to him, so it was bizarre.
That is totally bizarre. We're running out of time, so we got to rush through some things. Tell me a paragraph about working with the Talking Heads.
Brilliant. I just say it was just brilliant. A paragraph.
Now, brilliant is great, because you listen to those records and you think, oh, these are just brilliant, you know.
It was a brilliant record. It was all, we did it at Sundry, a little tiny studio where we did the Ramones' Leave Home. Mind you, Tony Bongiovi, great guy, a little eccentric, told me that I was producing Leave Home and told me that I was producing the Talking Heads records with him, the first Talking Heads record. Of course, that never... When I got the records back, it said engineered by. But that's okay. It's all good. I was young. What do I know? What do I know about producing? But it was great. The band was, again, well rehearsed. They just came into the studio and started recording him. And, I have to say that, Chris and Tina were tight. Chris, we did all those songs in one take. Those are one take songs. There's no edits or multiple, do five takes and pick different sections out. It was just fantastic, and it was an honor to be in the studio with such geniuses of love that Chris and Tina are.
Well, those are, it's kind of another record that you made that have become very influential records. You've worked on a lot of records that really helped change music. We were talking about that earlier, how sort of music changed a little in a short time from the days of Gladys Knight to the days of the Ramones. Let's talk about sort of the end of things when music changed, when really the music industry changed and recording became digital and all that, and I think you decided to sort of take a break for a while. Did you see that all coming down the road?
I didn't really see it coming. I was, I was busy, I was working, I was doing stuff. Another type of music took over, this pop stuff, and, hip-hop and rap, I have a lot of respect for the guys and gals that do this type of music, and it makes people happy, and people dig it, and that's cool, but it's just not my thing, and that's cool. Things change. There's things come around, go around, they said Columbus discovered America, but he didn't really. Rock and roll was taking a back seat, and the downloading of songs and, people not catching up with that in the right time. And we all know how the business has changed. And, I just got sick of the scene, too. I recall I moved to Colorado in 2003 with my wife, Amy. And there was just, one time an A&R person from Columbia Records sent me down to see a band called Zebrahead at the Roxy on the fabulous Sunset Strip in Hollywood, California. Zebrahead. So, okay, this show is at like 11:30 or something. I lived in the valley. I lived in Sherman Oaks. So I go over the hill. I refrain from having my cocktail at dinner. I drive over the hill. I get there, like quarter after 11. I park the car. It's on a Friday night. It's packed all over the place. I go up to the door, the window, and, say, Ed Stacey, I'm on the list. No, you're not. I'm not on the list. Okay. Whatever. I'll pay to get in. Sorry, it's sold out. I can't get in. No. Okay. That was it. I was just like, okay, I'm out of here. I don't know if this has to do with change of music or anything, but it has to do with change of scene for me. And, I went back and said to Amy, we had been talking about maybe leaving L.A., and we're just like, let's get out of here. And it just took off once in the Durango, Colorado area for 11 years before, we relocated recently to San Diego.
Interesting.
And, I kept busy. I kept doing rock bands. I worked with some great projects, especially one of my favorites over the years was a band from Flagstaff. They're called Blackfire, a Native American Navajo band, two brothers and a sister. Great stuff. They one of the players left, and they turned just the the bass player and drummer, Janita and Clayson, came up with another duo called Siahasan. And they're very spiritual, they're very cool, and that was a lot of fun doing. So, you know, I kept doing my thing, working with bands that I enjoyed, but I kind of just didn't pay attention to the business. As I said earlier in our conversation, I was, business never worked for me. I just care about the music. So, you know, I just kept on working with bands that I dug and that were friends of mine. And
that's still what you're doing now?
I'm taking off. I'm on sabbatical. The last record I really worked on was a band called The Empty Hearts, which is a bunch of old pals of mine from way back. Clem Burke from Blondie, Elliot Easton from The Cars, Wally Palmar from The Romantics, and Andy Babuk from Chesterfield Kings. And Andy has also written some fabulous books about the Beatles gear and the Rolling Stones gear and about Gretsch guitars. Andy's just a really good friend of mine for decades now, and we did that. It was a fun record. You know, it was the most fun I've had in years, really, because I went to Rochester. Andy has a studio, a rehearsal kind of place, but he had Pro Tools set up in there, and we set it all up. We did it live, all live. It was great. You know, hardly any edits at all. Everybody, not even using headphones. Wally had headphones because he was isolated, so he could do reference vocals. We just cut it all live. It was great. We did it in 5 days.
I can't wait to hear that record. I've heard about it. I haven't heard it yet.
It's really, really good. It's a lot of fun. We had a blast doing it. It was, go to my Facebook page. There's a video that I put up there of just a little about four of the songs, and it just shows how much fun we were having in the studio. It was a blast.
I want to remind folks, we're talking here to Ed Sasium, who's had, like I said, a long and varied career, and we've really just kind of touched the very top of it, but all these stories are sort of interesting and I think provide sort of a window into understanding how records are made and why they're made sometimes. I've got a track from the Ramones queued up, Rock and Roll High School, which your version of it. So at a certain point, what happened? They came to you and said, will you remix this yourself? Because we're just...
Actually, that version, I Want You Around and Rock and Roll High School at Cherokee Studios for the film Rock and Roll High School. We did demos at Sire. At the basement studio, did the demo, sent them to Alan Arkush, got them back, and then when it came time to do the film, we all went out to L.A., and we recorded Rock and Roll High School and I Want You Around for the movie soundtrack. I did mono mixes for the movie soundtrack, because everything, back then, surround sound hadn't really... We probably didn't even have the budget for surround sound, and didn't have the facilities either. But I did mono mixes for the film, but I also did stereo mixes, real quick. I mean, we literally did those in a day. All of that. It was two days. Did a tracking and some overdubs, played a couple little guitar. Here's an interesting bit of trivia on As Long As I Got You Around, I Want You Around. That's Joan Jett's Les Paul that I played for the power chords on that song. Mm. Just to let you know that. A little bit of trivia. Rock and Roll High School. So I did these stereo mixes, and then Phil Spector got the master mixes, and for the soundtrack record, Phil mixed in his wall of sound drenched in reverb mixes. And for years and years and years, I had a quarter-inch stereo copy that I kept in my vault. And when Rhino was doing all of those reissues, my buddy Bill Inglot, who was taking care of all of that stuff for Rhino, mastering it and compiling it, he said, "Oh, what's this?" And it was the stereo version. So back when they were doing the reissues, that's when those the quote unquote Ed Stasium version was released. I don't know who called it that, but. those were, it's actually the stereo mixes that were never released that were done during the recording of those two songs and during the making of the Rock and Roll High School movie.
Gotcha.
Yes. So that's the story about that.
All right. We're going to hear that now. Ed, thanks for joining us and waking up early this morning. I do very much appreciate it. It's been absolutely fascinating.
You bet, Michael. It's been great speaking with you. Love to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. There's a whole
lot. Love WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. And listen to it way back in the day.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
All right, talk to you soon. Thank you.
Happy solstice.